right. Well, I just want to welcome everyone who is listening to this because today I'm here with some very special guests who have just caused a bit of a media sensation for the UFO subject. So for some time now, the rumor mill has been churning within the UFO community regarding an apparent investigation and plans for a subsequent article by the New York Times regarding UFO crash retrievals, programs, and more. Now, this is something that a few of us have been directly aware of in relation to the investigatory efforts of the two New York Times journalists. We are going to hear from both of these individuals regarding their investigation and subsequent publication of their latest article that touches on the idea of UFO crash retrieval programs hidden within the US government or within private contractor world of aerospace and defense. After being aware of this investigation ever since these individuals reached out to my lawyer, Michael Hall, earlier this year, it is a great relief to myself to be able to speak transparently on this topic with the two journalists responsible for bringing this information into the mainstream. And so it is with the greatest of pleasures that I welcome both Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal onto the channel. Leslie, Ralph, how are you?
Great, Jay. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Jay. Thanks for having us on.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on and taking the time to speak with me. Since we are at the beginning of this discussion, my first question for both of you would be, how long ago did you start this investigation? Can you give us a date at all? And has it been a tough nut to crack, so to speak?
Well, when you say this event investigation, you mean specifically for this article? Because we've done a series and they're all kind of connected. They kind of flow from one to the next. So as you know, our first story was in 2017 of December. So I don't know if that's what you mean or if you're talking about this specific article.
But I was going to say we should leave some time to discuss the origins of our collaboration because it really is crucial to the discussion. It does go back to 2017, which shows you how long things can take. But the first story, which did prove a great sensation, that the Pentagon had a UFO investigation unit, despite the claims to the contrary over the years, that really goes back 3 years. So, we can talk about two different time, periods. The original story, which led to the story that we produced this week, and then the actual story this week, which, as Leslie said, goes back a few months.
Well, I think that would probably be the most sensible place to start. So, if either of you want to try and give us a bit of a backtrack on how this all started, beginning with the initial publications.
Yeah, I can start with that because the way it all started was, as you know, I've been reporting on UFOs, and now it's been about 20 years that I've been reporting on UFOs, and I wrote a book about it. So I had a lot of contacts in the UFO world. And in October of 2017, which was when Luis Elizondo, the head of the Pentagon program, resigned, literally the day he re resigned, I was invited to Washington to meet with him. I was invited by a few of his colleagues. There were four people at the meeting. And as we've reported on before, that's how it all began. I spent maybe 3 hours there in a hotel with this group of people. I met Elizondo for the first time and was shown extraordinary information. I mean, I had no idea there even was a program. And here I was sitting in front of the director and was shown, his background papers, was shown the videos, was shown a bunch of other documents and ones that we've since reported on. But at the time, I wasn't allowed to take anything with me. It was just like they were showing it all to me. And then I came back and got Ralph involved right away because Ralph has worked at the New York Times for a long, long time, and he's a link to the New York Times. He's a reporter for the New York Times. I had never done anything for the Times at that point. So I brought the story to Ralph, and we had a meeting with the head of the investigations. I think he was the head of a journalist, Mark Mazzetti, from the Washington Bureau, who does investigations. And we just pushed this, pitched the story to the Times, and they said, let's go for it. And that's how it all started. I don't know if, Ralph, you want to add anything to
Yeah,
that
well,
story.
you gave a good account, Leslie. When I know Leslie for many years, and when she told me that she had been at this meeting in Washington with Lou Elizondo and the others, it sounded like a sensational story that the Pentagon had a secret UFO unit. So I called or I emailed Dean Baquet, who's the executive editor of the Times. Now, I had left the Times as a staff member in 2009 after 45 years. So I still had my contacts there. So Dean, to his credit, did recognize that this was a story not in the mainstream of Times coverage, but it was a, you know, a unique opportunity to really break through to something extraordinary. And he put us in touch, as Leslie said, with Mark Mazzetti, who was up from Washington. We met in the New York Times cafeteria, and we already had a lot of documentation and laid this out. And the pitch was, which I'm really still quite proud of, that everything was on the record. We were not going to use any anonymous sources. You know, there was no, I mean, it was complete transparency. We had the documentation. We had people speaking to us on the record with use of their names. So that was not going to be an issue. So that's how it all began.
So, I mean, that's fascinating. And I think we've all seen the shift take place since 2017. Anyone that's been plugged into the community in terms of UFO research has noticed a fundamental shift from the, you know, the articles that yourselves have written to the To the Stars Academy revelations. And this actually leads into something I was going to say, that despite the shifting social climate regarding UFOs with the creation of TTSA, the admittance of the Pentagon's ORSAP or ATIP program, the Navy and Pentagon's confirmatory statements in relation to the three recordings of UFOs by Navy pilots, as well as the recent bill for transparency on classified UFO data proposed by Senator Marco Rubio, despite all this apparent headway, I can imagine that any story taking seriously the possibility of extraterrestrial craft or reverse engineering programs is a huge decision for a newspaper with the reputation of the New York Times. So I'm just wondering how hard it's been to get this into the paper.
Well, you know, the original story was not that hard to get into the paper. Once we met with the right people, laid out, as I said, the documentation we had, I mean, it did go through a lot of editing, and I wrote a piece actually for the New York Times, you know, sort of discussing what it takes to get a story on a controversial subject like this into the New York Times. I think I said, how do you get a story on UFOs in the New York Times with great difficulty? But to their, you know, in all fairness, they needed to ask the tough questions. So it went through rigorous editing. But but every big story, I mean, I've worked on a lot of investigative stories for the New York Times over 45 years, and every big story goes through arduous editing. And this was part of the process.
Would you say the...
Can I add to that? That I think, you know, I think, Jay, there's been a progression. Like Ralph said, the first story was just so clear because we had so much information, and it was such an obvious great story for the Times. And I think we then did the one in May of 2019 about the sightings off the USS Roosevelt. And then we did the one after that about the Freedom of Information Act documents that came out backing up those sightings. So there's been sort of a progression. And I feel that now discussions of crash retrievals are sort of the next step forward. And I think that if we had tried to do this any time earlier, it would not have been possible, really. I think there's been this buildup to it. And I also think it is probably the most difficult, I don't know, I think Ralph would agree with me, the most difficult topic to get out into the Times, because for all the reasons that you can imagine, because of its controversy and because the information about it is classified. And so there's only so much that we can bring forward, and that makes it particularly difficult to report on that topic, as well as it being so sensational. So it's been a journey with the New York Times to do this, and I take my hat off to them for going along with it. I mean, this is an explosive topic, and we're very fortunate that the New York Times is allowing this to be reported on. I think they're absolutely incredible to do it.
You know, and also we got to remember that with our earlier stories, we were able to obtain released copies of videos, Navy videos of these, you know, close encounters. So there was something to hang our hats on, that readers could see actual evidence of encounters with something. We don't know what, but those videos, by the way, are still the most watched, the most emailed, the most Facebooked images that the Times, you know, has ever put up. There's no end to the appetite of the public to see those images, and they're up there now on the Times webpage. Well, in this case, We didn't have that for the reasons Leslie said. The crash retrievals is a classified subject. We couldn't produce materials that were supposedly recovered. We couldn't produce pictures of crashed vehicles, all that stuff. That was a big handicap this time.
Well, this kind of segues a little bit into what I wanted to ask next, because I I agree with you that it's obviously it was a progression. It is a progression, and disclosure, in my opinion, is a gradual progression anyway. And I think it was Luis Elizondo that said it's already happened. It's just, you know, a process of unfolding now. But were you aware of allegations regarding UFO crash retrieval programs when you ran the December 27 story or the following story in 2019? And if you were, can you speak on what was holding you back from running a story such as this at the time?
I mean, I can say that I've been aware of these kinds of topics for many years because I've been covering this topic for so long, and some of the sources in our story, I've worked with them for a long time. So I've had it in the background of my, you know, my framework on the UFO issue for many years, but I have never felt that it was ever something I could report on. And I think, you know, that's an indication of how far we've come since the 2017 story, that it's even conceivable now that we can discuss this in the New York Times. So it's not like it's anything brand new, but it's something new in terms of being able to report on it now. And I think that's a real statement about how things have changed.
I agree. I mean, the closest we came in 2017 was in that story in December. We did report that Robert Bigelow, who was a contractor on the program and was close to Harry Reid, who got the money for the program, built a warehouse to hold retrieved materials. That was in the story. That's as far as we got. That's as much as we could find out at the time. Now, we've since learned that no materials were provided. They never were put into the warehouse. But we were able to touch on it. But as Leslie said, we did not know details, and it is a progression. So we built on the earlier stories, and now we got to the point where we can bring up this subject and report what you know, the fragments that are possible to report.
And the other thing is, Jay, the sources that we have would not have been willing to say years ago what they're willing to say now. I mean, they too are aware of the progression. They too are gradually opening up, and they're affected by the steps that have been taken, such as the Senate report coming out, you know, requesting that information be provided to the Intelligence Committee, et cetera. I mean, our sources would not have said what they're saying now 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
And you know, the growing willingness of the Navy to be responsive. You know, they put out new ground rules, actually inviting reports from pilots. They changed their, you know, procedures to ask pilots to come forward and said that they would take the report seriously. So all that, I guess, served as a signal that there was a greater receptiveness within the Pentagon to this issue.
We've kind of already covered what I was going to ask next, but I'll say it anyway, just in case there's anything else we can gleam out of it. So has the New York Times, you feel, been supportive of your current story and previous publications that have covered the UFO issue? And do you also feel that there is an appetite for this topic within mainstream media and the public, or is there still, in your opinion, a bit too much stigma?
Well, let me jump in on that. There's a lot of questions packed in there. The New York Times has definitely been supportive because they took on a very difficult editing job. The story, as I said, went through, you know, a lot of different permutations. We had a lot of information, as often happens in investigative stories. You know, reporters come up with a lot more information than they can eventually document satisfaction of editors. Things shift as you work on a story, and the Times stayed with us through this whole process. I mean, they easily could have said, you know, guys, this is too complicated. It's too controversial. We're spending too much time on this. Let's forget it. But on the contrary, they really stuck with it. And, you know, we did go back and forth on a number of things, but it was always with their commitment to getting the story in the paper because of the tremendous reader receptivity that these stories produce. I don't think there's an issue like UFOs that get readers going in terms of reaction, nothing close. So, you know, that's one part of the question. And then, you know, Leslie can answer the other part about, you know, the mainstream media. And I don't know how you want to reframe that, but let's take it step by step.
Yeah, Jay, you asked about, are you saying, the question was about, is there an interest on, in the mainstream media on the, about the topic? Is that what you were asking?
To actually reread it, I'll say, do you feel there is an appetite for the topic within mainstream media and the public, or do you feel there is still, in your opinion, a bit too much of a stigma?
I mean, obviously there's a huge appetite among the public. I mean, look at the response to the stories we've done. So I would say yes to that in a big way. And I think there's interest all over the media, because every time the New York Times does a story, it gets picked up everywhere. And I think, you know, most media don't have investigative reporters like us who spend months and months and months digging into things and then have a story for them. The New York Times is kind of taking the lead on this, and then the other media follow. But I think it's important that we are with the New York Times because of the importance and the stature that they have as being, you know, a very credible media outlet. And they're so rigorous in their editing that you can trust what comes out in the New York Times. I also want to just to add to what Ralph said. The editing process, one of the reasons it's long and complicated is because there are multiple editors. We don't just have one editor. There are many editors within the Times that have to sign off on an article, that weigh in on it. And so even, you know, the point being that we have a lot more information, as all journalists do, than what was in that story. But because of space issues and because of all the editors that weighed into it and a lot of other considerations, this is how the story came out. And we're happy with it. We think that it's better to move in steps. It's better to move in stages and do, you know, we'll do one thing at a time, and then we'll do another one, and it will gradually build.
Let me also amplify on that the process that I witnessed in all my years at the New York Times, which I'm not saying it's unique to the New York Times, but it is kind of a specialty at the Times. The way it works is you submit your story to an editor, and he or she will go over the piece and maybe suggest changes. And then at some point when the story is in some kind of shape, it goes to another circle of editors, editor or editors plural, who have no familiarity with the story. They're not clued in. They're not told in advance what to expect. And they read it with fresh eyes, and they suggest changes. And it goes up the ladder through, and sometimes an infinitude of levels, and ultimately to the executive editor, who's Dean Baquet, who again reads it with fresh eyes, not having been told in advance, this is what the goals of the story are, this is, you know, what they were able to do, this is what they couldn't find out. He or she, in this case, he reads the story afresh and comes up with his own questions. And often, and this is kind of a long-running joke at the New York Times, that after the story is in complete shape and been edited to death, you'll get a question. The masthead, probably meaning Dean Baquet, has another question. So that is a strength, ultimately, because every possible question by editors, still things, look, it's not perfect. The things, you know, fall through the cracks, and there are, you know, corrections in the New York Times. And but it is a wonderful process that smaller publications cannot afford. But the Times has made a specialty of it. It's just a rigorous process. And I think it helps their credibility. People know that by the time a story appears in print, it has gone through these steps and been vetted.
And that's also the reason that it takes such a long time for us to do a story. I mean, I think there was all this sort of frenzy that built up on the internet about this story. And, you know, when is it coming out? When is it coming out? Every story you do for the New York Times, especially on a topic like this, takes a long time because of that editing process. And also because the editors have many other stories that they're working on at the same time. So sometimes we just spend time waiting. We wait for the next step to take place or for the next round of edits. So it is a very long process.
Just think of the timing on the story. It's coming out at a time when, you know, the country and the world are consumed by, you know, the coronavirus, protests, Black Lives Matter, So it's not like, you know, nothing else is going on. Exactly. Quite the contrary. This story sort of elbowed its way in, having really no context into what else is going on today. So, and I want to say something else that Leslie, that you raised, Jay, and that Leslie mentioned. The frenzy on the internet with this story. I just want to say it does not help. If you're out there as a New York Times reporter trying to put together a story, to find this traffic back and forth about, you know, giving away snippets of your story that maybe your sources, you know, were able to impart to somebody else, or little leaks of things that make your life more difficult for people who supposedly are concerned about getting the truth out, it really gets in the way. And it annoyed us to no end, to have to worry about not only nailing down the facts of the story, but, you know, keeping it, watching our backs, because people were sniping at our heels, and they're going to do this, they're going to do that. And speculation often based on absolutely no information whatsoever. This is what they're going to talk about. This is what the Times is going to do. And it really is a very infantile environment to be working in for a serious subject. So I would, you know, urge people in this field who seem to or say they have the interest of, you know, getting at the truth at heart, to give reporters a little slack when they're serious reporters, when they're looking into something, because it definitely got in the way.
No, I can sympathize with that, because obviously, you know, some of these things take an extremely long process, and revealing key bits of information halfway through that process can dismantle the entire thing. So I completely agree with that. So I think,
yeah, I mean, we basically don't want any other, you know, we don't want competing media to even know we're working on a story at all, period, you know, and let alone, you know, have people talk about what they think the story is going to be about. The other problem is that there's such a buildup of expectation that then some people, when it comes out, express a disappointment. What is this all it is? And I think the power of the story gets lost in this kind of frenzied expectation that was built up. And I want to make the point that Ralph and I had absolutely nothing to do with any of that. This is a self-generated, self-created kind of intense, you know, discussion and rumor and all this stuff. And then it's just sort of like when the story comes out, you know, oh. So it's just, I would echo Ralph. It would be of great help, I think, to us and to everybody to not do this in the future. It just doesn't serve any purpose that I can see.
Well, this is something I talked about in a video I put up recently just on my channel, just addressing, you know, the fact that in the UFO community specifically, I think sometimes we're so overly saturated with information and, you know, people claiming different things. And there's so much, and I understand and sympathize with the community because I'm part of it. And, you know, it is difficult when you see the mainstream world and for whatever reason, they're not picking up on the story or they're not understanding it. And, you know, I can sympathize to that extent. But at the same time, I feel like sometimes we're so oversaturated with data and information that the rest of the world isn't, that we fail to recognize the implications of something of this level coming out within the mainstream arena. Because, you know, we're trying to convince the senators, the lawmakers, the people who have, you know, a good level of influence. And it's important that people in the UFO community, in my opinion, get their recognition, because we've been relegated as conspiracy theorists and tinfoil hat crazy people for so long. And now you've got pilots and senators and, you know, government officials speaking quite clearly on the subject. And so I feel that, you know, there is a level of recognition for the UFO community, but it can become very bitter, in my opinion, just because of the fact that we have so much information floating around. And so I would agree with you, because I feel that this is a really important article to push forward the story. You know, I would have loved to have seen a little bit more in there regarding the Admiral Wilson leaks and things like that. But that's, you know, maybe something that will be covered in the future. But one thing that I would like to address, and it is the elephant in the room, so to speak, that being the recent walk back by former Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid regarding what was originally quoted in the article, because Senator Reid was quoted originally to have said the following: "I came to the conclusion that there were reports, some were substantive, some not so substantive, that there were actual materials that the government and the private sector had in their possession," end quote. Now, the story has been corrected to say that that Senator Reid only said that this may have occurred. He also posted a tweet last night that stated the following: "I have no knowledge and I have never suggested the federal government or any entity has unidentified flying objects or debris from other worlds, I have consistently said we must stick to science, not fairy tales about little green men. So I find it hard to believe that such a direct quote would not have been checked by Senator Reid prior to publication. But due to the considerable walk back from Senator Reid, my initial question on the topic is, did the New York Times check the original quote with Harry Reid prior to publication?
Well, wait a minute. First of all, Jay, the quote was never challenged. The quote has stayed in the paper online just the way we wrote it. It has not been corrected, not been changed, not been disavowed by Harry Reid. We have two direct quotes from him in the paper, and neither of which has been challenged. What was changed, as you noted, was a paraphrase attributing to him views that we believe, or believed at least when we wrote it, were accurate. He took issue with that, and it was changed to say he believed that crashes of vehicles may have occurred. So we accepted that change. But the quotes that are in the paper have remained unchanged and unchallenged. So let's remember that. Now, Leslie can address the other question of why, what he's saying now. But I think that's important to remember, that the main basis of our story, the quotes, have not been challenged.
Right. I mean, the only issue he raised specifically and asked for a correction on was this sentence that Ralph read, and it's printed on the internet below the story, the change that we made, which was really about wording that was used to paraphrase something. It wasn't even a quote. He didn't raise any other issues with the story until the next day he came out with this tweet. Now, we don't understand why he said that, or what's behind it, or, you know, there's a lot of speculation. Is he being pressured? We have no idea. We know that we did a very in-depth interview with him, took excellent notes. We know what he said to us, that he gave us a lot more information than what's in the story. And we stand by the reporting that we have in our story on him. In our minds, there's no question about that. And he feels a need to pull back from it. And why he's doing that, we don't know, but that's his decision.
You know, he was also a mainstay of our first story. There was no problem with that at all. He never disavowed any part of that. We've had a good relationship with him ever since then. We've, been in touch with him periodically, these UFO stories. So we consider him, a great ally to the, to the search for truth and transparency in this issue. So, politicians are subject to a lot of different pressures and things. I don't know. But we only are really concerned with what we've said in the story, and the story stands up.
Yeah, and to echo that, we have the greatest respect for him. I mean, we're not happy to see this happen. But with full respect for the senator, if he needs to say what he said, we respect that. And I think he seems to have an issue with it being in print, that there's some association between him and the notion of these objects being from other worlds. Just seeing that, even though in discussions it seems clear that that's what we're talking about, and he has said many other things that imply such an understanding on his part. But I think, as a politician, as someone in the public sphere, he may not like to see it actually written that boldly. And I respect that. But it's not inaccurate what we wrote in our story.
With all respect to Senator Reid, he does seem to be mocking the entire notion of potential life, virus corrective Twitter comments. I don't know if you're concerned that, basically one of your main sources is walking back a little bit from the things he was saying in the article and openly mocking the idea of quote unquote little green men.
Well, no one's talking, Jay. No one is talking about little green men. I don't know if they're green. I don't know if they're men. people say things lightly and joke. So that's part of the problem. This field attracts ridicule, and that's one way of disarming critics. People move very quickly to ridicule. But let's keep in mind, what we're talking about. We're really talking about facts that we've been able to establish in the story about briefings to staff members of Congress, to high-level intelligence and defense officials, that briefings that reference reported crashes and retrievals of materials. We're not going beyond that. There's no speculation on, you know, men green or otherwise. We're sticking to facts, and the people who are most involved in this, smartest on this, people like Lou Elizondo, make this point repeatedly that it is folly to go beyond that and start to speculate. The only way this issue is going to be responsibly addressed is by sticking to, you know, what can be confirmed. And we found it extremely telling that this information was imparted to members of our government in classified briefings. We were only able to see unclassified parts of those briefings. But that, to us, is a very telling fact. You don't have to go beyond that and start to speculate, you know, well, what planet are they from? And, you know, well, that's nonsense. It gets in the way.
So I have some information that was provided to me by a very credible and trustworthy source that you have, at the very least, two corroborating senior military sources, and that these senior military sources testified on record to the existence of a UFO crash retrieval program. So I'm wondering, maybe Leslie, if you're able to confirm this.
Well, we have the sources in our story. If that's what you're referring to, we have named sources in our story. Dr. Eric Davis, Luis Elizondo, and then Harry Reid was the third one. We have other sources, but we don't name sources that are not in our publications. But maybe your source is referring to Davis and Elizondo? I'm not sure.
Maybe they're referring to sources that were left outside of the story.
Yeah, well, we have other sources that are left outside of the story, but we're not in a position to name who they are at this point.
That's okay, but are you able to confirm if there is anyone else that's confirmed the existence of UFO crash retrieval programs? You don't have to name them, but if you have a source outside of this story?
I mean, I would say they've certainly suggested or, you know, indirectly supported. I mean, it's very hard for a lot of these sources to be super direct about something as sensitive and something classified like this. So I would say, yes, we have other sources who have certainly supported what we are saying in our story as being accurate.
And I would add that we have really been made a fetish of the fact that we only want sources ultimately who can who are comfortable enough to be quoted. We don't want to write a story that you often read from, you know, Washington correspondents that, you know, deep throat says this, or, you know, a source who cannot be identified said that. That takes away from credibility, especially on a story like this. Maybe in a diplomatic story you can get away with it. You know, somebody who knows what Putin is thinking said this or that. But on a story about UFOs, you do not want unnamed sources. So, yes, we have a lot of people we've talked to, but until and unless they're willing to come out on the record and be quoted in the story, they're really not much use of us, use to us in this reporting. Yeah, you know, we like to gather as much information as possible, but we, from the very beginning, as I made that point, we stressed the fact that this story is all on the record with named sources. So I think that adds to the credibility.
And I think, though, Jay, the other sources do, what the way they do help us, I mean, yes, they can't help us with the actual text of the story, but they give us added confidence that what we're saying is accurate. And they just, that's basically what they do. They bolster what we're saying so that we actually have a lot more information behind what we're saying than what we're actually just able to say. And that's the value that other sources have, because then, you know, we have great more certainty and confirmation about what we're saying, even though we can't name them. They provide a lot of background information for us, which is very helpful.
Well, that makes sense. And I'm assuming then from that they weren't willing to actually go on the record with their name and make it public.
That's, yeah,
well,
some of them aren't.
That's not quite...
Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that some of them were willing, but there wasn't room for them in the story, or the story didn't go in that direction. So it doesn't mean that these are the only people who are willing to go on the record, the ones that Leslie named. There were others who may be willing in a subsequent story and were willing, actually, to go on the record. But we couldn't get them into this story. So
are you able to expand on why that took place in terms of not being able to get them in?
Space. I mean, we were given this amount of space. The Times made a decision.
Was there information often, not key enough?
Say again?
Was there information not, you know, key enough to the investigation? Then?
Well, this was what the Times was prepared to verify, to back, based on the information we came up with. We didn't dispute that. As a matter of fact, sometimes a compact story carries more punch than a story that meanders all over the place. So we were allocated this amount of space. It wasn't written in stone. If we wanted to add a paragraph or this or that, we got that in. Some things we wanted to have in were cut out. But there was not infinite room to put in all these other people. So maybe they'll get into a subsequent story.
You clearly believe that there have been retrievals of extraterrestrial spacecraft, correct? And that's for both of you.
Is there a question there? What was the question?
Do you believe that there have been retrievals of extraterrestrial spacecraft?
Look, what we believe is less important than what we've written. What we've written is that members of Congress or staff members of Congress and high-level DOD intelligence officials have been briefed on crash retrievals. That in itself, I think, is pretty sensational. Whether my personal belief, I think, is irrelevant. Clearly, I find that information compelling. We found that information compelling that members of Congress were briefed on it. Members have been briefed, and staff members in particular, which we quoted in the story, and high-level members of the intelligence community and the Pentagon have been briefed on it. So that's more important than what I happen to believe.
And to add to that too, Jay, it's the briefings are extremely important. The fact that they've been going on at all, they would not be briefing high-level officials about something that had no weight to it. But it's also the people that are going on the record about it and have said that this has occurred, or they will go as far as they can in saying that, are people that have been deeply involved with this subject for a long time and people with high clearances, high access to classified information. These are the people that are in the position to know more than anyone else. And so, we feel the combination of the fact that the briefings have occurred, that we have the best sources who know the most about this, and that we have documentation to back it up in the form of briefing documents, really present a picture that, these things have occurred. And, of course, we can't go as far as we want by actually proving that, which was the point that our editors made to us and the point that we made in the story. But it comes very close to that when you have authorities like this speaking out about it, and when you know that they wouldn't be wasting their time and they wouldn't have interest in materials that, unless these materials were connected to UFO crashes, otherwise they wouldn't be of interest to the UFO program, they'd be of interest to some other program.
Are you concerned that due to Senator Reid's recent quotes, the credibility of this most recent article might be damaged and potentially cause other publishers to be reluctant to follow your story?
No, not at all. We've had long history as reporters, investigative reporters, with having people quibble with things we've written. We stand behind everything we've written. When we've gotten something wrong, we've acknowledged it. The Times always does that. I think the story's rock solid. The fundamentals of the story have not been questioned at all. The quotes have not been questioned at all. I don't think there's any chance in the world that this will diminish credibility or interest. I think it's just the impact it's already had in terms of the reader interest and the way it's been picked up will testify to that.
Well, one thing I'd like to say is that obviously isn't the confirmation of sentient life in the alien life in the universe is probably the biggest story of the millennium. And why would the world's supposedly greatest newspaper, no offense, maybe dial down on the content? Because there is a lot of speculation online and there is obviously a lot of people talking about, the fact that there's been deductions. And as you said, some of this is for space reasons, but there is obviously going to be a lot of speculation as to whether that's entirely true. And whether there was actually some more explosive information that perhaps was decided to be left out.
Well, we report what we can confirm. And, you know, again, the fact that high-level members of the government have been briefed on crashes of potential, a possible off-planet, off-Earth objects, vehicles, is pretty sensational, it seems to me. Now, again, you got to remember, this information is classified. Whether it should be classified is another question that Harry Reid actually addresses. He says that more should be made public, and that's the aim of the Senate report, as you know. But whether it deserves to be classified or not, it is classified. So we are not able to bring this information out. The last thing that you want to do as a reporter is traffic in illegal information, because then you give the government a big weapon against you. So we're very careful to stick within the law and not traffic in not that we easily could, but the material we dealt with was unclassified. And the program itself, by the way, the Pentagon UFO program that Lou Elizondo headed, is unclassified, although it deals with classified matters. So, it is kind of amazing, you got to think, that we were able to get this much that we could, without delving into actually classified materials. So, there's a lot of other stuff out there, but we can't confirm it. It's classified. So maybe at some point, this is a progression, we'll get to it.
Yeah, I just want to comment further, Jay, because you brought up the whole question about aliens, right? I mean, I have a bit of a problem because people do tend to extrapolate, like you'll see people that pick up the story and they'll have something in the headline that says, New York Times says aliens have crashed on Earth. And, if that's what you're asking by your question, I just think, it's very important not to take this beyond what we are actually reporting and what we actually know. And even if there are crashes that have been that are being reverse engineered, our sense is that they have not made a lot of progress with that reverse engineering. And I don't think anybody really knows much about where these craft are from or all the questions that everybody has a desire to understand. And so I think, jumping to notions that there are aliens, intelligent life flying around or whatever, I mean, it's a logical question to ask, but I don't think we have the answers to that yet. And we just have to, as Ralph says, be very careful about taking this one step at a time. And I don't know if that's what you were asking about, but there is a sort of a jumping off that a lot of people want to make for good, for understandable reasons. We all have those questions. We all want to know the answers to those questions.
Yeah, I'd like to stress how far we've come in this reporting. For many years, the question was, are these objects real? I mean, do they have a physicality, or are they somehow imaginary? Are they interdimensional? Do they, pop in and out? And our reporting over the last few years certainly suggests that these things are real enough to be picked up on Navy videos. And that is a huge step forward, that we're not talking anymore about imaginary objects or archetypes or, all kinds of mythical, things flying around, religious manifestations. It's that we're talking about actual physical objects that have been tracked and seen. And yes, the next question is, well, what are they? Where, are they from? Who's running them? But we're not close to answering that question. At least let's figure out what the physicality is first. And then we can probably deal with these other questions.
Yeah, I think that's important point, that the question of are they real is really not a question anymore. And when you reflect back to 5 years ago, say, that really was still a question. I think now they're talking about these objects as threats. I mean, the Senate reports, the Senate Intelligence Committee report that just came out on June 17th, and the thing that was attached to the authorization bill is referring to the object as a potential threat, and that's why we need to understand them better. The ATIP program has referred to them that way because, not because they literally are a threat, but really because when you don't know what something is, that is showing, is demonstrating this extraordinary technology that, as far as we understand it, we don't have on Earth, you have to consider it a potential threat because of its advanced capabilities. And so the fact that that kind of language is being used and the fact that this is being discussed by the Senate Intelligence Committee and that they've made this request public to receive a report from the Defense Department, I mean, it does show the issue of their reality is absolutely in the past. And I think that's something that's a really important moment that all of us can reflect on. And also to add to what you said about the UFO community, Jay, I mean, I thoroughly respect the great work that the UFO researchers have done. And I have benefited from that work tremendously. And I have no way mean to discount them. It, you know, we were talking specifically about the kind of chattering about our story, which isn't helpful. But the research that many investigators have done in the UFO community is outstanding, and I respect it, and I value it highly, and I just wanted to make sure that the people out there understand that.
Well, thanks, Leslie, and I'm sure that everyone listening does appreciate that, and I agree with you. One thing I wanted to rewind back on just real quick, because we are talking about reverse engineering in regards to the article, and you just brought up your opinion if there was any level of reverse engineering, then you feel it was probably a long process without much success. And I'm just wondering if that's an opinion brought on by your research into the Admiral Wilson, Eric Davis notes.
You know, I probably shouldn't have. I don't know. I don't think I can expand on that anymore. It's a sense that I have from sources I've spoken to. But I really don't think I can say anything more about it, Jay. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine. Do you feel that there is anyone that may be running interference against your story?
I'm not aware of any interference against the story. And I never have been in any of the other stories. I mean, yes, there are skeptics who will criticize it and people who don't like the New York Times, and there'll be people speaking out against it. But interference, I would say no. Would you agree, Ralph?
I would agree. And I would say that, you know, the New York Times, as a rather big tent, has a very vociferous cadre of science reporters who have, you know, looked at our stories with, you know, very under a microscope, you could say, and raised issues when they thought we were going too far. So some of that skepticism is at the New York Times, as it probably should be. There are people with different takes on things, very smart people with a scientific background who are taken aback by some of these stories because they're not in the scientific mainstream. However much we try to stick to, you know, provable facts, it's quite a leap for people who, you know, do, you could say, normal or conventional science reporting. So some of our stories have been gone over by our own science people, and they've raised questions and issues at times, but the stories have all appeared. I don't think anyone is agitating against them. I think it certainly everyone has the same interest at heart, which is to get the best possible truth out of the situation.
Well, mainly the reason I ask that is because I was told that one of the editors did try and block the story, and that was Liz Bunler, the Washington bureau chief and Washington editor. So I don't know if you're able to comment on that.
That's absolutely not true, because she edited the story.
She was one of the editors, right?
And first of all, if she was against the story, it would never have seen the light of day, believe me. And there's nobody who would have overruled her, because she's the Washington bureau chief. And if she was against the story, there would be no story. I can tell you that. So this is an example, Jay, of the kind of gossip that is circulating around without real knowledge, because these people do not know the inner workings of the New York Times, or they may have a source at the New York Times who tells them snippets of things, but it's just not true. If there was any significant opposition at the Times, or certainly opposition by a senior editor at the Times, this story would not have run, period.
Did you ever get to the stage of discussing the story directly with your New York Times editor, Dean Baquet? Was he given the opportunity to kind of review the evidence?
It doesn't work that way. He's up in the stratosphere. He's got a lot of other things to worry about, including, by the way, the management direction of the New York Times with the publisher. They just named a new CEO. So he's thinking about a lot of other things than UFOs. but he has the ultimate authority and the responsibility. If something would be horribly wrong with a story, our story or any story, he takes the ultimate blame. So he comes in just at the end to look it over, and he could certainly have killed it at any point if he wanted to. But it's not a situation at times where we would be chatting about the story as he's asking us questions. It doesn't work that way.
Right. If Senator Reid was pressured potentially to pedal back a little bit on what he was saying and release these recent tweets that he has, would you be worried at all that any other potential witnesses will do the same under similar pressure? As journalists, do you believe the national security establishment is trying to shut the story down at all?
I mean, I wouldn't have that concern, Jay. I mean, I think all the sources who have spoken to us, I mean, Reid obviously has some concerns, but we haven't heard about any concerns from the others. And both Eric Davis and Lou Elizondo have spoken on the record before. And, I just don't think there's some sort of national security kind of force to try to shut it down. And I think these individuals are very capable of handling anything like that. They have no regrets that they came forward in our story. And so, I think that Harry Reid has his own issues going on, his own concerns, his own reasons for doing what he did. But I don't think this applies to the other people in our story.
I mean, and also Harry Reid has a long history of being sympathetic to this research. He got the original money for the ATIP program for Lou Elizondo. He's been very supportive, to research. So I don't think it's fair to make him out to be somebody who's changed his views or who's working against this thing. He had some quibbles with the way, certain things were phrased. We've corrected it in one case. But I think it's important to keep it in perspective and realize that he is a true friend of transparency. I'm sure he'll continue to do that.
Right. Well, I think that's absolutely correct. Yes.
The reason I brought up any sort of national security concerns and any sort of pressure on additional witnesses, and again, as you said, as both of you have said, to be honest, it can just be the rumor mill churning around, which is kind of going at full speed at the moment. But from what I've heard via those that are in contact with Eric Davis, there is a slight pressure on him to withdraw the term classified from his acknowledgement that he gave a briefing on a classified UFO crash retrieval program. So I'm not sure if you're able to comment on the legitimacy of that at all.
No, we can't comment on that, Jay, because that's something that only Eric Davis can address. It's not for us to address.
Okay. Was further evidence provided to you by Eric Davis of him giving this classified briefing or any mention of acquisition of exotic materials, such as those supposedly under the cooperative R&D agreement between TTSA and the U.S. Army? Did Eric provide any more, anything else that was not subsequently published?
Well, we have to say we spent hours on conversations with our sources, Jay, as journalists always do. So there was a lot more information that we had than what we could present in the, 1,000 words, which is what our story was. So the answer would be yes, for all the sources that we talked to have provided us with a lot more information. We can't go into the details of what that information is. But Eric was very, very forthcoming with a lot of great information. And that's about as far as we can take it.
I think it's also important to say we did not receive any classified information, period. We didn't ask for it. We wouldn't have been given it if we'd asked. We won't traffic in it. We understand the legal issues involved. And this was not that kind of a story where we had to secretly receive classified information. I think it would have undermined our position and given the government a good argument to denounce us. So we were very meticulous and careful about what the material we handled. But yes, we got a lot of information, as Leslie said, that we didn't, we couldn't verify some of it. We couldn't, documented to the extent it would need to be documented. Everything in the Times was the phrase we like to use is bulletproof. A lot of it, but none of it was classified.
Right. That's really important that our sources are so careful to not reveal any classified information. They are all absolutely astute in respecting their limitations there. And none of them have ever breached that with us.
You know, I just want to echo something Leslie said before, and I think it is an important point, that a lot of good information does come out of the UFO community. There are a lot of smart people there who have a lot of time, more than we do, to go over, you know, documents and information and, you know, videos and whatever. And that can be very useful. The problem is it's a mixed bag, and stuff that is, I mean, there are people who are very rigorous in their approach, people like Rich Dolan, who are very, and you, Jay, who are very rigorous in their approach and careful and understand what the issues are. And there are other people, because it's not policed. It is the Wild West. So yeah, it's a grab bag of, you know, of reliable information and not reliable information. And that's the problem, that people coming to it from the outside might click on something and find, you know, a totally unverified, you know, report right next to somebody like Rogovin, you know, and The Drive and others who are really knowledgeable people, real professionals who have spent time and tremendous effort and expertise in developing this field. So we are very grateful to the people who have, you know, out there who have spent the time and who, you know, churn through this information and put stuff up. But it's a mixed bag, and it's mixed in with all kinds of malicious gossip that made our life difficult. But certainly there's a lot of good to it, too.
No, and I completely agree with that. One thing with Eric Davis, because he's becoming such an icon within the community, I would say that he's held up quite a lot by a lot of people who have a lot of high regard for him. And it's very interesting to me. I loved seeing his name being mentioned in mainstream media. I've been watching news reports. Hearing his name being mentioned is quite amazing, because so many people I speak to in my life, if I'm trying to talk to them on these subjects, they have no idea who Eric Davis is, or Hal Puthoff, or Luis Elizondo, Christopher Mellon, etc. So it's, you can see that this is starting to creep in, and articles such as this have definitely pushed that forward. I'm wondering if Eric Davis is going to be someone you feel you will be using again if you are doing any further publications. Is he someone that you feel is quite close to your story?
Well, we've already spent a lot of time talking to these people, our sources, and I don't know who we're going to go to now, who we're going to keep using or go back to. I mean, people have been very helpful in our preparing this story, but I really don't want to discuss, you know, who we're going to go to next or go back to. That's part of the whole reporting process that I'm not comfortable discussing.
Yeah, we also don't know, Jay, what the future will bring in terms of any restrictions that might be placed on some of these people, in terms of what they can say in the future, or what they're, you know, whether they have restrictions placed on them with their employers, or, you know, it's hard to predict anything for the future. So we just can't really say, but I have tremendous, and so does Ralph, we have tremendous respect for Eric Davis, and he's a fantastic source. He's been very cooperative with us and very, very helpful and forthcoming. And so we take our hat off.
You know, and also I want to say that, we are hoping that other people who read the story may come forward and say, oh, we like your story, we have more information for you, or persuade them that I wasn't going to come forward and talk publicly, but now I will or I can. So we're certainly open to new people coming forward, and I hope they reach out to us. There's obviously a lot more information to be gathered. We always welcome, you know, information, people coming forward. So we're hoping that there'll be a lot of other people out there with information, credible people who will come forward.
So you've actually hinted at this a little bit. Twitter has picked up on a few comments left by yourself, Ralph. One such comment was, and this is a quote, apologies if this is a paraphrase, you can correct me if it is, you can't publish everything all at once. So how significant do you two believe this specific story is, and are you planning to take it further on? Are you going to add to this story specifically, or are you looking at other things in the future?
Well, we're definitely looking to do more reporting. You know, there was a gap between our first story in December 2017, which broke the big news about, ATIP. We followed up a year and a half later with a story about the pilot's reports. Then a year after that, we had the story of the close encounters and the accident near accident reports, near misses. So, you know, there's a gap between them. It takes time. But definitely, I don't see this as the end of it. I think we'll definitely be doing more reporting. You know, a lot, there are loose ends that we want to tie up, go off in new directions. It depends on the information we get. So certainly there's more to be done.
Absolutely. We have more information that we could not include in this story that just came out. And so we have plenty of things to follow up on. And we will definitely be pursuing this. I mean, this is what we do. And we're interested in doing as much reporting as we can on this.
Well, that leads to kind of the last little question. Obviously, without ruining or damaging any potential future publications, is there anything you were not able to put into this latest story that you really wish you could have seen in there? And if so, is there any chance you can tell us what that might have been?
No.
Yes, there was, but no, we can't say what it was.
You know, if we had more space, or, you know, if we were able to verify certain things that we couldn't quite verify, yeah, sure, there were things we would have liked to include. But we got the main parts of it. We caused a big impact. You see the evidence every day in, you know, in the New York Times, and the most watched and the most emailed. So, you know, you in reporting, you don't cry over all the things you wish you'd gotten in. You move ahead and you figure you'll get them in at some point.
Right. So we just have more information to follow up on and to shape and to dig deeper into that will come out in other stories.
Well, look, I am really appreciative of you two coming on here and speaking with me. This pretty much concludes the line of questioning I prepared for you both. So is there anything you want to add, anything you want to say on record before we finish this off?
We just want to thank you for your interest, Jay, and your sensitive questions and your understanding of what we're able to say and can't say. We love the interest out there that verifies the effort, you know, we put into these stories more than anyone will ever understand that goes into making a story like this. So we do appreciate the people like you out there who take interest and ask good questions and you know, keep the public informed. So thank you.
And I would echo that. I thank everybody out there who is supportive of what we're doing. And, you know, we're all after the same thing, which is the truth, and to find more answers about this topic. And our job is just to take a lot of the knowledge that the UFO researchers already have, of course, but we take this knowledge and this information to the mainstream. And that's sort of the role that we play. And I think everybody has a role to play in this. And our role is to take the information to the New York Times, get it vetted so that it's absolutely ironclad and can therefore impact policymakers and the future direction in which the bigger picture will unfold. And we appreciate everybody you know, recognizing that that's what we're doing and recognizing the battles that we have to fight and the difficulty of doing that. And we also thank everyone for all the information that they have provided to the world themselves and all the great work that's been done. And we hope that and thank you for the support from everybody.
All right. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you both on. I hope we can reconvene in the future if we do see any further publications from yourselves on this topic. And on behalf of a community of people that sincerely want to see the truth surface up out of the shadows, I just want to tell you to keep going, keep pushing. This is incredibly important, more important than, unfortunately, many people currently recognize. And it is through the efforts of people such as yourselves and all the independent researchers within the community that we finally see this topic given the level of awareness and subsequent action that it absolutely requires. So thank you again for coming on and speaking with me, both of you.
Thank you for having us, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.